360's The Week That Was, the most listened to hour in Territory Radio. The Territory leaders break down this week's big issues.
It is Friday morning, though. It is time for The Week That Was, proudly brought to you by BTC Constructions, my favourite day of the week, Friday morning, for various reasons. Joining me in the studio is the Deputy Leader of the Opposition, Jared Mailey. Good morning.
Good morning, Katie, and good morning, listeners.
We've got the ALP's Minister for Territory, Families and Urban Housing, Kate Warden. G'day, Kate.
Good morning, Katie.
And we, you know, this is the first time, is this the first time I've had you on the show since becoming a minister?
It is.
I picked it. Didn't I?
Oh, you did, Katie, you did. I was just noting, you know, the intro. I'm going to go ahead of you here, but today is about Territory Leaders. And Matt Hepworth, you've just had a... You're a leader, a Territory Leader today?
Oh, well, apparently I'm for the next hour, yes.
Welcome.
That scares
Matty
me.
Hepworth, look out. He's leading us. The blind leading the blind.
That's a worry.
It's always good to have you guys in on a Friday morning. Now, look, there's always plenty to cover off as well. And I might just make mention at the beginning of this segment, and it's not really something that we'll have much of an opportunity to discuss, but it is being reported this morning in the NT News that a high-profile Northern Territory police officer has been suspended from the force after he was charged with various offences. The 37-year-old man, who cannot be named for legal reasons, appeared in the Darwin local court for the first time on Thursday afternoon after being arrested on Wednesday night. Now, Maddie, you'll have some more detail for us on that one throughout the local news, but given that it is before the courts, probably best for us to not comment too much on that.
Yeah.
So I might take you across to a story which made headlines throughout the week, and that is the fact that 77 Charles Darwin University employees are looking as though they're going to lose their jobs under a proposed restructure to get the budget under control. Now, the university is seeking feedback on a draft change proposal to unify vocational education and training, as well as higher education across the university. The draft proposal provides $10 million in savings through financial efficiencies across the university, and they say positions CDU for growth with better pathways for more vet students. But look, I think the really difficult thing in this situation is the fact that we are looking as though we're going to see some job cuts for Territorians. We also then heard throughout the week that INPEX is looking as though they're going to lose some jobs too, but we might just focus on CDU to begin with. It does seem as though some of the decisions that they're making really need to happen in order for them to be viable. But, gee, it's tough when you've got Territorians looking down the barrel of losing their jobs.
Absolutely, Katie. And it's sad for anybody, particularly during COVID times. And we're looking, obviously, the Northern Territory is really well placed. I heard an article this morning saying that, you know, we've got more jobs advertised now. We've got more Territorians in work than we did pre-COVID, which is fantastic news. But any job loss for anybody is tricky and challenging. But This story with CDU has been going on for quite some time. I remember meeting a few people, came into my electorate a while back. I think it started with its midwifery courses and now it's moving into the vet area. What we're really keen, obviously NT government does provide some funding for vet because that's a really important pathway for young Territory kids to be able to go into, and adults. But what we need is we need them to, and this is what we're taking from this, they're reshaping that to make it really robust. You can't have areas that are making a loss and others that are, you know, doing very well. And it also needs to be tailored to the type of jobs that we've got. So I know that those conversations have been happening in the background. So hopefully, you know, all of those people that might lose their jobs will find something relatively quickly. But also that, you know, we come out of this with a really robust vet sector.
And it's going to be, I mean, that's the thing that's going to be absolutely pivotal here, is that they do, if jobs are lost, that we are able to find these Territorians or that there are jobs around for them to go to. Because otherwise the real concern, Jared, is that they then move interstate and we don't want to be losing Territorians at this point in time.
Yeah, that's correct. Territorians are important to stay up here and we need to make sure we look after them. The Labor government went into the election saying that they're going to keep us safe and keep our jobs. And remember, the CDU is funded by the government. The government spent money on the silks and also $10 million in the Cullen Bay. They could have diverted that money into the CDU and keep those jobs if they wanted to, but they didn't do that. So they've really let Territorians down. Remember, funding comes from the government. The government haven't given the funding to the CDU and the CDU had to put off staff. So really this reflects badly on the Gunner government.
I think that's completely wrong. CDU is predominantly funded by the federal government, as are universities across Australia. There are universities across Australia that are currently reconfiguring themselves post-COVID, and they're having job losses across Australia.
But those two things are completely separate,
Gerard. That's disingenuous to say that, you know, we certainly didn't fund silks, for starters. That was done by the turf club themselves. So just merging that and sort of making some bigger statements just doesn't cut it. We can't divert funding. We fund them for particular outcomes, which is what's expected of us as government in the vet sector, and that's what they get our funding for. They're funded federally around all other things. So don't merge the two.
But you said in your opening that you fund the vet courses, and yet the government have got the ultimate decision. They've got the power to make the decision where the money goes. They could have given the grant, which was made ultimately silks, to the CDU, or the $10 million to Cullen Bay to CDU.
Silks was built by the turf
grant
club.
The grandstand, though, did come from a $12 million funding provided by the Northern Territory government for the grandstand at the turf club, obviously.
Obviously, and that was a few years ago, and that was an infrastructure grant out of an infrastructure budget. What Gerard is talking about is money we put in to support the vet sector. We continue to support the vet sector at CDU. They continue to get our funding. What they're doing is reshaping their courses. We wouldn't have a say in that,
you could have given them more money and they could have, they wouldn't have had to restructure as much, and those Territorians could have kept their jobs. Remember, the Labor government went to the election on, we'll keep you safe from COVID and we'll keep your jobs. It's simply untrue.
Now, the big thing that's coming through, I've got to say, throughout the week from our listeners, is a lot of people questioning if CDU's got to make these changes right now to the vet courses and they're losing staff and they're having to restructure things, how are they going to be able to afford the new city campus in the CBD? Now, I know that we'd caught up with the Deputy Vice-Chancellor earlier in the week, and she had explained that obviously there's a NAIF loan for the CBD campus and that it is attached with that building having to happen in the CBD. And I suppose we all understand that, but what I'm really starting to question is how on earth is CDU going to be able to afford to run that city campus, also have the campus in the northern suburbs, and then also the one at the waterfront, if they're in the situation that they're in right now where they're having to restructure and kind of looking like they're downsizing.
And as you said earlier this week, obviously it's been made quite clear that federal government funding from the NAIF will be to build it, but it's afterwards as well. It's the operations of all those different campuses. And we've already seen with some of these vet courses that a lot of them were just not financially viable as well. There was obviously a lot of money going into it. And we heard in some of those situations that there were no current enrolments in, I think, some of those 19 courses that are going to be cut. There was no enrolments whatsoever. And there did seem to be a little bit of doubling up. We spoke earlier in the week, the example that there was quite a few different refrigeration and air conditioning courses and different certificates that can all be covered in one wider qualification as well. So it sounded like there was some doubling up. But, I mean, if this is going to save $10 million a year, obviously once that city campus does come online, the operational costs are going to be quite high again. So hopefully we're not saving on one hand and then 5 years down the track when this city campus is up and running, that, you know, is going to take away from all those savings that we've made.
That's right. And I think the other argument or the other discussion that's well and truly worth having, and I'm sure that CDU is at this point in time. But, you know, we know that obviously the international students, they are quite, you know, that there's big issues there at this point, obviously, with COVID.
But it is a growth area.
It is certainly a growth area, yeah. But I suppose the other thing that I always think about, it, and Maddie, you and I spoke about this earlier in the week, is different universities around Australia obviously specialise in different types of things, which really draw people from all around the world and all around Australia to those campuses. And the example that I always give is James Cook University in North Queensland, because they focus on marine biology and some of those real marine sciences. And what you see then is people coming from all over the world to study there. Now, the territory is so unique in so many different ways, and the university may well be really focusing on some of those different studies, and I'm just not aware of it. But I think if we've got a niche market and if we've got a market that is really unique, is there a way that we can really capitalise on that to try to be drawing people from other locations all around the world here to study in what we all know is the best place in the world?
So, Katie, that's a really good point. And I've had a presentation and sat in on a presentation around the new campus. And, I mean, they are questions, but they do know that there is a big growth and there is a big demand in international. And so their focus is on international at the same time. So it makes the university robust enough to provide all those vet courses, obviously, for locals, which are equally important. But one of the things is that, you know, that they need somewhere that's nice and close and connected to the city. We know that international students, that's what they want. That's their big driver. But at the same time, they want, it's interesting, some of their rationale is around the size of CDU and the size of Darwin itself. Mm. So there's obviously options around Australia for bigger universities, but often they're looking for a smaller quality university. And I know that CDU sort of got outreach campuses in the major cities, but they actually are inundated with students that are looking for that smaller campus rather than the bigger. And they like the intimate setting. And rather than being in a class of 100 kids, they'll be in a class of 25. And that's really important when they're looking for quality in international education. So that's what that main driver is about, having the city position here closely connected to accommodation, walking distance, etc. It's forward thinking, and that's definitely where they're headed.
And we have to be careful about the funding, because funding is important. There is going to be the university spreading out, and there's going to be more money to do that, and there's some NAIF funding to build it, but the operational costs, that's coming, and we don't need a crystal ball to see we need it. So the government need to make sure they start working with the CDU now to make sure those funding issues are resolved in the future. So what we don't want is to see exactly what's happening now happen in 3 years and 5 years or 10 years down the track, because as Maddie said, we don't want to do it now and have to do it again later. We need to make sure that the model goes forward and progress right through for the next 10 or 20 years, because the CDU is important. We need to make sure that young Territorians can get an education here, stay here, and then work here, because that's where the growth is. We need the economy, we need their work, we need to pay the taxes, they need to be able to go to the shop, buy the bread, go to the mechanic, get the car fixed, because all that's just a flow-on effect of having these people stay in the Territory.
360's The Week That Was for BTC Constructions.
It is Friday morning, it is The Week That Was, and big thanks to our sponsors, BTC Constructions. In the studio with me this morning, Jared Maley, Maddie Hepworth. I was thinking of there, and Kate Warden. Now, the big issue that got everybody talking earlier in the week this week was that of the situation at East Point, where we obviously saw drinking hours remain in place as they are. Now, the Darwin Council unanimously rejected calls from the Northern Territory Police Commander, Matt Hollenby, to reduce drinking hours at East Point, suggesting it wouldn't reduce or change antisocial behaviour in any way. Now, we know that the elected members at that meeting had raised the fact that they were concerned that by reducing those hours, they wouldn't solve the antisocial behaviour issues and would only upset those that are doing the right thing, who want to enjoy East Point. And look, we heard this very loudly on the phone lines and also on the text line throughout the week. A lot of people saying, is it going to make any difference in any way, shape or form by not allowing people to drink after the hours of 7 p.m. And then a lot of the time, the problem drinkers, you know, they can be problem drinking at any time of the day.
Well, quite simply, it didn't pass the pub test, to pardon the pun, really. There was a lot of anger around this proposal. And, you know, even Convat Scarlis, the mayor of Darwin Council, openly said that the time is not the issue. It's the secondary supply as to how these people are getting a hold of alcohol. And then we heard from Matt Hollenby a little bit later in the week that he said, well, we have other resources that we are now looking at. But, yeah, it certainly seemed you were getting a lot of angry calls. Messages about this, saying that it was punishing the majority for a minority.
Well, I'd have to agree, Katie, because obviously I've been on council and I think it came during my time, because it's not just East Point.
No.
Nightcliff has got public drinking, so you can go down, watch the sunset and have a glass of wine if you're a drinker and that's what you'd like to do. And I think the majority of people do the right things. I think what's happening here is, and I think let's a bit of an elephant in the room for the whole week, is that there's an enormous amount of money with the job seeker expansion around.
Very
and so
true.
People are accessing, often illegally accessing that secondary supply. For me, that's a law enforcement problem. And I think that you, you know, actively, we've got 24-hour, our government brought in 24-hour sobering up shelters. So, so because there's a recognition that people don't just get drunk after 4 p.m. So these people need to be picked up and put into the sobering up shelters well before the antisocial behaviour actually starts. But then it becomes a matter of resourcing. And to be fair to our police, they are stretched at the moment because of COVID.
Absolutely.
We've got them out on our borders. And we all want that. So we want that safety of the borders. And I think they're delivering that in spades for us. And we're all really grateful. But I think, you know, this is a matter of enforcement. We do need to start, you know, getting in more proactively and get people in and connect them through to services that can help them. It's not just a matter of, you know, closing those drinking hours down.
Mm. Yeah, and Kate, I agree with your listeners. You can't penalise the people to do the right thing for the few that don't. This is the alcohol and social antibehaviour is a part of a big issue that needs to be addressed. Labor have been in power for 4 years. They need to do that. They need to work harder because we don't want to penalise people to do the right thing because there's a small people who don't do the right thing. And remember, if there is a law that becomes at 7 o'clock, that's going to stretch resources even more because we've got to enforce that law.
Yeah.
So it's going to make even more strain on the resources. Okay, 7 o'clock comes, we need to go down and start doing tours and patrols the area because there's another law that needs to be enforced. So, again, it's going to put more strain and resources on the people who enforce that.
And I reckon it just, like, it, you know, we've been having these types of discussions for quite some time. And you know, Kate, you mentioned Nightcliff earlier. We'd heard that earlier in the week as well, that Nightcliff at different hours. The city as well. And even at the moment, you know, at that same council meeting, council extended the security guards that are actually operating in the CBD at the moment, dealing with these issues ordinarily in our CBD. But then what we've seen is those concerns move to other locations. And this is the broader discussion that needs to be had. You know, this isn't just a situation where you've got people, you know, that are drinking in the city or drinking in one place or drinking in another. We do have a small cohort that are obviously homeless, and that is a homelessness issue that is a tough one that I know that, Kate, you as the now housing minister are going to have to, you know, to have at the forefront of your mind. But it's also an issue that we've got with, you know, some people coming from communities and they're in Darwin and, you know, they're here for a few days or whatever period of time. They maybe actually don't have somewhere to stay. They're then staying in the long grass or staying down at East Point, and are getting intoxicated in some cases, not in all cases. But then we've got this situation where we've got public drunkenness, however it's, you know, wherever
whoever
it's originating
it
from and whoever it is. You know, it can be people that are, you know, that live here all the time that are actually engaging in that public drunkenness. But the worry is that we've got to try and make some inroads in this space. We've all been talking about it for such a long period of time, whether it's time to have the discussion more broadly about, you know, whether some remote communities should be able to have small amounts of alcohol in those communities, if it is community-led and women, and women are okay with it in those communities, or whether we need to, you know, to look at having a facility, like we were talking about off-air earlier this morning, where if people arrive from communities, they can maybe stay there for a small amount of money, can maybe have a couple of drinks there and stay for a few days so that they've then actually got somewhere to be that's not
safe.
East Point. Yeah.
Because you remember, we're trying to drive tourism up here and bring people from interstate to Darwin. And what we don't want to give them is a bad experience of coming up here and enjoying our beautiful country. We've got the best place in Australia for sure. And we don't want to spoil that experience by coming up and seeing antisocial behaviour. Remember, the Labor government brought in the fixed alcohol floor pricing to fix this. Obviously, that hasn't worked. So the Labor really need to look into what they're doing on the alcohol policy and make sure they do something about it, because we do not want the tourism people come up here, have a bad experience. And remember, not just the tourism, the local people. People come in from Howard Springs and Huntingdon, come into the city and they see some bad social behaviour. That is bad, and we need to fix that, because coming into the city should be a pleasant experience. I've got a young family. I bring my children in to buy some ice cream. Mm. And the last time we did that, we saw there was people drunk, and not just Aboriginal, everyone. Just itinerants, homeless people. So I'm not saying in one particular type of person.
No.
It's everybody, and it's across the board. So it really needs to be looked at, and the Gunner government need to fix it.
There is provision, and the Riley Review does talk about. So the Riley Review is not just one fix. It's a broad range of measures. I think we've spoken about that ad nauseum on this show. But and those things effectively do work. But one of those ones that we can't do anything about at the moment is alcohol back in communities. And I think this has to be, you know, the days are gone where, you know, bureaucrats in Canberra or even in Darwin can tell people in communities about control. We're very much at the forefront of local decision making, and this falls well in that area. So essentially, the Riley Review does give us that impetus to do it. But to let me be really clear to people, at the moment, we cannot. it's not something we can do. The draconian measures that came in for the intervention are still in place.
So what would have to happen, Kate? Would
they expire next year? So, Katie, importantly, there is a date, and I think it's mid-next year they expire. So beyond that point, it's really important that we're prepared to have that discussion with remote communities. It's out of the Northern Territory government's hands. We can't have those discussions. But, you know, the Riley Review has given us the to do that. And I know that... several of us have talked about it and how important it is. Many communities will reject it. Many communities, women and children feel that it's a safe space without it.
Mm.
But that's about local decision making.
Absolutely.
We can't make those decisions for people. The time has gone for that. So I think that's a really important, robust and mature discussion to have. And I think that next year you'll see some of that coming through.
Now, what about when we talk about people coming in from communities that maybe don't have somewhere to stay? At the moment, are there options for them?
Correct, there are. So we opened at the beginning of COVID. There is out at Batten Road, run by the very capable Yili Riang. There's a place where people can go. It's not a place you can drink, I believe, at the moment, Katie, but we are working towards that. There's 300 beds there.
Are they usually fairly busy?
So that we've only opened 50 because we wanted to see if it worked or not. The community that I'm listening to have said to me that they find it a fantastic space to go to. It is there is a fee for service for people to go there.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're looking at, Katie, is the very thing that you just touched on before, is we need to provide a place where people can, be taken off the street and be provided some safety, but also a place where we can get service providers to offer, certainly not force, but offer a range of services that can assist people to get their lives back on track. So it's that double opportunity. We're working through what that model might look like, and it's important that we don't rush that work because you get things wrong when you rush them. We did open that for COVID, as I said, 50 beds, and it's been very successful, and I understand it's full. So there is a space for people coming into town.
At what point, you touched on it before about having proactive policing and getting to some of these areas before the antisocial behaviour starts at East Point. What powers do police have at the moment? If they were to drive into East Point now and they saw a group of people congregating and there was alcohol being consumed, but no offences were actually taking place, what powers do they have to move them on to get them to the homeless shelters, and what role do, say, like day patrol and night patrol then have in that as well?
Well, you said it yourself, Matt, but no offences, nothing.
But if they come back 6 hours later and all of a sudden there's violence and public drunkenness, there's obviously a point, where that tipped, that changed.
They're completely they're offences. So you have to police have to base it on offences. I mean, public drunkenness, I believe, is still an offence. You can't be highly intoxicated. I understand it. I might be completely wrong, but
I thought you couldn't as well.
No, I think I remember my husband might have been.
Well,
I reckon up when he was about 18.
I was
going to
say, I reckon I may well have been when I was
Katie.
Younger as well.
Obviously, the powers that be. They are. I think public drunkenness and antisocial behaviour are triggers for a police intervention.
Yeah.
You'd have to speak to the police about that. And as I said before, at the moment it's a matter of resources. But I'm really keen and the police are too. We're really trying to get that secondary supply because I don't know if you've ever seen some of these areas. I always worry about, the cars coming and going.
Yeah.
And you can clearly see that there is some intent in that. And that's where we really need to do the hard work, because the supply issue, getting around the banned drinkers by getting that secondary supply, that's a real problem. The increase in grog running, I believe there's been a bit coming over the borders as well.
Mm.
We need to stop that, because that's, these are really vulnerable people we're talking about that are on the banned drinkers register for a reason. Not just,
that's right. They shouldn't be able to. And nobody should be providing them with alcohol in any way,
absolutely.
Shape, or form.
Because remember, antisocial behaviour is part of a bigger issue and it needs to be fixed. And Kay used the word can't earlier on. It's not the word can't. The government need to have the political will to fix it. I know that's easy to say and it's hard to do because it's a big issue and it's been going for a long time and there's no quick fix. But the Gunner government need to have the political will to make tough decisions to be able to fix it.
Oh, we do.
360's The Week That Was for BTC Constructions.
You are listening to The Week That Was. Joining us in the studio this morning, Jared Maley. We've got Maddie Hepworth and Kate Warden. Now, we do know that on Wednesday next week, the federal budget is going to be handed down, but there's already, a bit of discussion about whether the Northern Territory is missing out. Few sort of announcements made throughout the week, including some changes to the NAIF. We know that there was also a tourism announcement made. The Federal Labor Party have said that the Morrison government's latest regional funding announcement is another dud that pits regions against others and leaves the Northern Territory behind. They've said rather than coming up with a plan to drive recovery across regional Australia, the Morrison government has instead selected 10 regions to share in over $100 million over the next 2 years, while leaving nothing for the rest of the country. And they have said that the Northern Territory is not eligible for any other funding through this scheme. Look, I think it's probably a bit early for us to tell whether we're getting anything in the federal budget or not, or exactly how it's going to fare.
Unfortunately, federal budgets are built on state versus state and region versus region, and it's part of that speculation we all do as journalists and as those in Parliament at the moment as well. We want to know how much money is going to come through to the Northern Territory. And in many ways, for the next few days, there'll be a lot of state versus state, region versus region on who's going to get the funding as well. I think a bit like the Northern Territory, though. I mean, you look at all the stimulus package that the federal government's rolled out as a result of coronavirus. Some of the big spending that we've seen in previous federal budgets just isn't going to be this year because we don't have the money for it.
Maybe this would be a good topic next Friday to talk about after the budget's been released, and we'll know a bit more about it. All I can say, I just hope that the Labor government have been down there and working hard to get as much as they can for the Territory.
Oh, Jared, I can assure you, we have got a ready list. We haven't got just a list of hopeful things. We've got shovel-ready projects. I think that's one of the things in the past. There's always been a lag. You know, you've got some aspirations, but we've actually got shovel-ready projects. But I think one of the really good things at the moment is that through COVID, and I'll pick that point up, Chief Minister Michael Gunner has got a really robust relationship with the federal government. Often, you know, when you've got a Liberal and a Labor, they're often just fighting amongst themselves.
Well, we certainly know Daniel Andrews and Anastasia Palaszczuk don't have a real good relationship.
Well, you know, what's going on at the moment? The great thing for Territorians is that Michael Gunner does have a really good one. And I think you're right, Katie, it's just $100 million is very unknown and we'll all wait and see. But there has been a new spirit of collaboration, which I think is quite exciting. And
yeah,
I think
with the National Cabinet.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And the NAIF stuff you touched on.
Yeah.
In terms of the NAIF, like, we've been calling for a long time for it to be broadened, so, you know, what's possible in that space, and I think that's really good news because I think the Chief has been quite critical before and it's been slow. So hopefully we'll get more investment, and here you go, Jared, and more jobs out of it.
Well, we bloody
jobs
hope
are
so.
Important, that's for sure.
Well, because this is the thing, we do know that obviously these changes to the NAIF funding, they were made earlier in the week, and it is all about trying to really make sure that more projects are eligible to get that NAIF funding. And that's actually something that I'd interviewed Nicole Manison, the Deputy Chief Minister, about earlier in the week and brought into the discussion. You know, when you see these job losses in some industries, you then, unfortunately, the ramification of that can be people moving interstate. So bringing industry into the Northern Territory, trying to diversify, is such an important next step. And actually, after 10 o'clock this morning, we will be catching up with the Territory Economic Reconstruction Commission co-chair, Paul Henderson. Right. But I think that this is, you know, it's something that we really need to be talking about is what is next for the Northern Territory. So often we sort of, you know, we hear these different projects sort of spouted. We know that something like the shiplift is due to kind of, you know, to get underway. But we've really got to try and diversify. We've got to have some different industries entering the Territory to hopefully bring more jobs to the Territory and bring more people here.
Because this goes to the issue that the red tape and approvals. So lots of people come and talk to me about business saying it's really hard to do business in a Territory because trying to get approvals is very difficult. Like, I think there's 10 or so mined ready to go just waiting on approvals. So remember, the NAIF funding's at the very top of the tree. You don't get NAIF funding unless you go to the NAIF with all the approvals. So it goes back to the Labor government with the problem of getting approvals. You need to be able to go to NAIF and say, this is the package, this is what we've got, these are all our approvals. And we talk about mining, for example. Here's my mining approval, I'm ready to start mining. We just need funding to go and buy the equipment. That's where the problem lies, is with trying to get those approvals from the Northern Territory government. And that's what I'm asking the government to work harder and get those approvals in line with the interim report by the Reconstruction Commission, which says they've got to shorten those approvals. And of all the 45 ministerships, there's no minister for approvals, which I think is a very important thing. We need to be able to get approval happening quicker, and it just proves the Gunner government hasn't looked at that and or missed it, because approvals needs to happen quickly and needs to be done so people can go and apply to NAIF.
It is something we've been hearing quite loudly and clearly from industry for some time, Kate, you know, trying to get that approvals process sped up. It does sound like it's something that's really important to streamline.
So the good news is that, yes, the Reconstruction Commission has highlighted the need for that, but there's been a lot of work going on that. So I've seen a whole range of things this week of where that is actually happening. And Katie, you're right, you do need to diversify, and but you also need the bigger projects, because they have a flow-on effect. So, you know, the ship lift is not just about the construction jobs and then the ongoing jobs, because they are quite high numbers for that particular project, but it's actually about what comes after that. So that ship lift will be our, you know, we'll get trade coming here rather than going elsewhere. But the other
apparently bloody Queensland's
they don't get a ship lift, and then the boat which is going to be based in the Territory go to Queensland to get service. Yeah. So the Gunner government are on notice about that now. That's happening, and it could
Queensland
be a real risk. And they really need to make sure that we get those contracts, because if it doesn't, there's going to be a ship lift sitting out there not being used, and that's going to be directly at Mr Gunner's feet.
Well, I think you'll find that we're well ahead of the game, and Queensland are just joining the party late, and they're going to be terribly disappointed.
Well, we're going to find out.
So we will see.
The Gunner government's on notice that there's a problem, they need to fix it.
And Queensland are just talking about it.
Didn't this happen with the Aboriginal Art Gallery, though? Adelaide jumped in and said, hey, we'll do it.
Because we took too bloody long.
There's still that back and forth between the Alice Springs Council.
Well, we stole Impex as well from Western Australia. So this is the thing. You've got to be right on your game, and you've got to be
ready to go. And I think you'll find that we are absolutely ready to go.
Well, I think things not enough. It needs to be. We're talking a lot of jobs, a lot of money. It needs to be high on Mr Gunner's agenda to get this, get the contract and get the work to stay here, because it's all about territory jobs, like you said, Kate.
We need those people to stay here. There's 400 construction jobs in the shiplift alone.
And we don't want them to lose them to Queensland.
So we won't be losing to Queensland. Queensland can get back in its box today. That's my message.
I thought you were going elsewhere there for a second, mate.
Not going to do that to Katie on air.
Better not.
It can get back in his box.
I have heard that that's happened before, but
someone else in your team's done that.
Nope. I've laid the ground rules. There's certain words that you cannot say on this show.
But Katie, it's also exciting. I mean, it's the time to sort of mention that the diversification comes from setting the groundwork right. We've done an awful lot of work in and around Katherine over the last term to get that set up to be an agricultural hub, just getting all the settings right. We've done a massive work with changing legislation, so the hemp industry, for example, can take off, and others. Diversification on pastoral leases is important. We've seen that nationally. And then you've got gas. Once the gas is coming out of the ground here, and, you know, whether people like it or not, that allows manufacturing with cheaper energy costs.
It really sounds as though it's the resource that the feds want. If I am reading the tea leaves correctly, is that our gas is what they want, and they do want us to be a manufacturing hub. So I suppose it's about, you know, making sure that we are able to get all those approvals moving along able to get things moving along quickly. Because I always think, you know, through a really terrible situation like we've seen with COVID, it actually presents opportunity. And I think that's how we've got to see it. We've got to sort of see ourselves as being able to you know, to try and get things moving and to move more quickly than maybe what we have been.
And I think, Katie, you know, everybody wants to do things quickly, but what it's really important to do is make sure you get the risk level right. So, yes, if things can be delegated down and done very easily at a lower level, get it done if the risks are low. But where there are risks, and mining industry is a really good case in point, yes, we'd love to get new mines going, but we have seen in the Northern Territory in the past where mines have been given really quick approvals and they've fallen through, the company goes bust and they leave town, they leave a big hole in the ground. The community is do the community accept that. Katherine, the community of Katherine will tell you that they've been very disappointed by that in the past. So what's important is to get that regulatory framework right, make it as easy as possible for people to transact with the government so it's smooth, actually tell people how long it will take to get those decisions so everybody's on the same page, and make sure you meet those timelines rather than rush it through and get and all the risks are there and we carry the risk or the community carries the risk.
I've had people say that they put their application in 18 months later and still no approval. That's just too long in my view.
Well, you should be raising that directly. you know, with the Minister for Mines. But there are approvals, and a lot of this is environmental concern that people are, will be raising. So we need to get what the trick is to be, it's not the trick. It's the really important thing to get right is the balance between risk to the community and making sure that
it's not held up. In some cases, though, like we've heard from Drew Wagner before from the Minerals Council, that they've been waiting 4 years in some cases to get approvals for mines. And I understand, like I totally understand that when you're talking about, depending on what you're mining as well, it can, you know, the environmental impact can be massive. So you've got to make sure that you get it right. But I just think the whole argument has been within the mining industry that if the process takes far too long to do the same type of business here as what it does in another part of Australia, if it's taking 4 years here and 2 years in WA, well, you're going to flow across to WA.
And not even the mining industry. We've heard examples as well where if someone wants to start up a new bar, the amount of different departments that they have to go through as well.
But I can assure you, Matt, we're working really hard on that. And one of the things that we've, we're also looking at is a lot of those older processes, and we're working within processes that have been in place for a long time. You know, it's one decision after the other. And so what we're now looking at is where decisions can be made in parallel. So you're not waiting for... And I think particularly in the area you're talking about, the liquor, you know, so you might be applying for a liquor licence, but you also might be applying for, you know, an outdoor area to be used.
Yeah.
Allowing those to happen concurrently is exactly what you're talking about, rather than, you know, one being contingent on the next. And that's really important work. And I can 100% ensure everybody that's listening today that that work is feverishly underway across the public sector.
And we need to make sure we don't just focus on the big businesses. We need to make sure we focus on the territory business, the people who've been here for a long time, you know, the mums and dads who've been here working. They're the business we need to protect. So we need to invite big business, but we also need to make sure that local business is protected, and they need to get the work.
Absolutely.
360's The Week That Was for BTC Constructions.
You are listening to Mix 104.9. It is The Week That Was. It's always good fun on a Friday. And we've got Jared Maley, Matty Hepworth and Kate Warden in the studio with us this morning. Now, the footy is going to be under the lights tonight. I think, I don't know who's more excited in the studio. I know Matty Hepworth's very excited.
Well, I'd love to say, I'm very excited for it. Unfortunately, I won't be there, though.
Is it tonight or tomorrow night?
Yeah, tonight's the first opening round. Yep, Waratah v Palmerston.
Under lights.
That's correct.
It's
taken a long time to get there, but credit where credit's due. It's done now. And we were chatting about this earlier this week, Katie. I think it's really special for a number of reasons, because pre-TIO Stadium, you know, Gardens Oval is the spiritual home of football in the Northern Territory. So that alone is really exciting. But the fact that we've actually had these lights installed, one of the reasons being the expansion in local football in our junior leagues and in the women's league as well. It's actually to make way for more games can be played across the day and at night time as well. So it's a really exciting announcement, and I think they're expecting a big crowd down there.
And I always think when you're playing the lights, the standards lift because it's cooler and people are a bit more excited, and it's just a mental thing that you play hard. I remember when I was playing footy, and you played in the middle of the day and you're sweating and you're hot, but you get the night game, it's cooler and you try
still
harder.
Still sweating and hot though.
I just think the standard of the game, no matter where you're playing rugby league or Aussie rules, just lifts, and it's more exciting and the crowd's there. So it's just it lifts everything.
Yeah, so anybody that's even spectated at 2 o'clock, which I've spent years doing down there watching my husband play football, at those 2 o'clock games, not even running around, it's horrendous. In the wet season, it's even worse. I guess I've been advocating for close to 10 years, and I do want to give a massive shout out today to Bob Elix, who was a former alderman on the council. He and I were constantly ragging on to anyone that would listen about lights at Gardens, because they've needed it. It's overdue, but it is a council facility.
Yeah.
So all kudos to the former sports minister that got the urban lights funding, and we'll see Nightcliff, and then after that, I think Bagot next, and then Nightcliff later in the year, which is equally as exciting.
Yeah, I actually thought the ones at Nightcliff and that were up and running already, but obviously not. But it's so important, not only, like we've said, obviously for throughout those games and for the women and for the juniors, but so you can train, I'm assuming, as well, throughout the week for some of those fields, you know, at a reasonable time of the day, rather than making it really difficult for some of those.
Well, it's an additional 104 games a year, Katie, and I think what's important is, Maddie's point's really important, so there's two factors. It's catering for a growing game, including women, which is exciting, but also, you know, cricket is using that facility as well, so they can now play under light. So it's 104 games across sports, but that's just that oval, which is very, very exciting. Mm. But if we continue to see growth, it's important that we can have all of those games under lights. And it just extends and takes people out of the heat of the day, which I think as we're experiencing all over the world, it's getting hotter. So it just does gives that extra opportunity. Bloody excited tonight.
And I just think the more that you can get young people and people out playing sport, the better. I come from a family that always played sport. All weekend, I can't even remember ever being allowed to sit at home in front of the telly without going to sport.
Me too.
But I just think it's such a great thing for the community in every way. So if it means that there's more people out there playing sport, it can only be a good thing.
It's about crafting the sport to our lifestyle. It's tight during the middle of the day. We've got some rooms that has put some lights and just play the sport.
Yeah.
Too right.
Well, that's it for us this morning. Great morning. Great to be with you all. Jared Maley, of course, the Deputy Opposition Leader. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners.
Maddie Hepworth, our News Director, and we'll have you back in a little bit later with the latest in local news.
I'll see you soon.
Sounds good. And Kate Warden, the Minister for Housing, Urban Housing and Territory Families. I can't remember all those portfolios. I'll get
sport,
used to them. And sport,
it will be very important tonight. But
absolutely.
So, Matt, you might want to look down from your plane tonight.
Oval a wave.
Give us a wave as you go past. But exciting times. I'll see as many people down there as possible tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much for your time. You are, of course, listening to Mix 104.9's 360.